There he is, Rudy. I'm waiting for you, man. Jesse. Hello, Jesse. Good evening, everyone. Ah, mate. That's great. We also have mate here in Brazil, especially in the south. My wife comes from Santa Catarina, which is very close to Argentina, and sometimes we have it. It's just too hot here where we live now, so we don't really have it very often. Okay, there he is, Marcello Consultoria. Let me wait for him to invite himself. So we're going to talk about something super controversial today. I hope you're ready. I hope you don't get pissed by the things we're going to say. But that's okay. There he is. Welcome, everyone. Hey.
Hello.
What's up, buddy? All good?
Yeah, I'm good. And you?
Yeah. I'm doing fine, man. Yeah. I mean, you know, considering all things considered, right? The whole pandemic and got my tea here.
Oh,
with
yeah,
some
me too.
Chamomile.
Yeah, me too. It's here.
Yeah. Here's so cheers, tea. Cheers.
Cheers, brother.
Yeah. So how are you doing? I mean, I know we're hanging in there, but everything okay, right?
All yeah, good. I guess. So. Yeah, everything's fine, man. What about you?
All right.
Are you all right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was rereading a lot of stuff because I want this episode to be super special. So yeah, I was checking my sources since we're going to talk about something highly controversial and people are going to get angry. I mean, maybe not angry, but it's okay if you get angry too.
And just don't call us names, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's, you know, it's not us. We're just reproducing what other people did, you know, other scientists and and authors and researchers, right?
Yes. And but don't forget that we have something very cool to tell everyone at the end of this episode. We have something very cool to tell them regarding the international conference.
And we forgot to say that before, right? I mean, this is like the third time we try to say it. So let us hope we don't forget at the end.
No,
right?
We're not. Just a quick reminder, guys. So if you're here with us on Instagram, and if you have people who don't have access to Instagram right now, this episode is also being streamed directly to YouTube. So you can follow us on YouTube as well. You don't have to stick with us here on Instagram for some other reasons. If you cannot join us here, you can go to Instagram, and this episode is also going to be uploaded to Spotify later on.
Awesome.
As soon as we have some, a window. A window doesn't do the job anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe a gate. As soon as we have a gate or something. Like
sure.
That.
Awesome.
So today is very controversial. On something very solid here, but it's not solid anymore. So I'm basically having to hold the whole thing up here.
No problems. You should see what I'm actually holding my phone on. I have a tripod on Stephen Hawking's book, you know, A Brief History of Time, on a box of Friends DVD, you know, on a black table. So I'll take a picture and post later.
The backstages, right?
Yeah. So let me just say it. I'm gonna go out there and say it.
Just go.
First of all, everyone, learning styles is considered a neuromyth, okay? I know everybody's going to get angry. I know that according to a bunch of surveys done in the last decade or so, a lot of teachers actually believe that we have different learning styles, that we can learn best if we're taught according to our learning styles. But there's a lot of evidence, robust evidence, showing that we don't necessarily learn best because we don't have learning styles. We have learning preferences. Yes. And just because you prefer to do something a certain way, it doesn't mean you're going to learn it better if your teacher teaches you like that, right? Mm-hmm. However, and that's what we're going to talk about, However, there we shouldn't just throw everything away. You know, there are a lot of practices that came from this whole learning styles theory that we can definitely use in the classroom. And I think in a way, and a lot of people will disagree, it kind of benefited everyone involved in the classroom environment, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think, and then people who have been teaching for a longer time, they can maybe help me out here. I think that before the learning styles theory, most teachers used to believe that students learned in a very specific sort of, not particular, but very unilateral way. Yeah. And then when learning styles came out, they were forced to think about, oh, there are different students in the classroom. I have to cater for those students' needs. But actually, everyone benefits from all learning styles, if you think about it, because we have all of them.
Exactly. Right?
So I just said it. I'm so much more relieved. There you go.
You got like 90 times out of her chest, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So
because, it might be complicated, but we'll discuss.
I mean, just to confirm what you have just said, some people read whatever Gardner wrote a couple of years ago, some decades ago. And for some reason they thought, okay, so, all right. So my students, they are going to have this profile and they are going to learn this way only. And the problem is one word, only. He never exactly. said that in his book. He never mentioned anything like that in his book.
Yeah.
You know, what he says is, guys, we have a list of profiles. We have a list of intelligences.
Exactly.
So basically, guys, feel free to explore each intelligence the way you want. More importantly, what he actually said was, we have a list of profiles here, a list of intelligences here. He showed us how to explore each profile better. How to explore each of them, but he never said one person has only one profile only.
Exactly.
He never said that.
That's it.
But for some reason, that became some sort of pop culture among teachers. That's pop culture.
When we say that
learning style is a neuromyth, the neuromyth is actually that we have only one style and that style is going to be explored and we're going to learn through that style only. Neuromyth. Because that's not the case. And as you just said, we have all styles within ourselves. Some of these styles we like, some of these styles we don't, but they're in us.
Exactly.
Unless we have some sort of impairment, some sort of neurological or biological impairment or physical impairment, a special condition. But if we don't, we all have these styles and we can explore each of them according to the feedback we receive, according to the responses we receive from our students.
Yeah.
And this is
really the outcomes, right?
Yeah.
So if I tried something this way and it worked, I might try it again. It might work again. It might be the best way to teach that particular student, but it doesn't mean that they have a single one style, right?
Not at all. And once again, when we were preparing this episode, we were actually thinking, who the heck came up with the idea that we're going to learn only through a specific style? Because seriously, I have no idea who came up with this idea because this idea is actually nonsense, you know?
Well, I'll tell you so I was rereading a couple of stuff that I, a couple of things that I wrote 2 years ago, 1 year ago or so on my blog. So if you want to check it out. So I have this blog post series on neuromyths. Mm-hmm. And this one is about learning styles. So the whole idea started in the 70s and we had cognitive profiles that, psychology was becoming much more popular. We were studying people's attitudes and behaviors. And then we had Walter Burke with the VAK, the V-A-K, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, right?
Yeah.
And we also had David Kolb. And then I actually wrote here. So David Kolb and Neil Fleming, they were the ones who proposed the accommodator, converger, diverger, assimilator. And then this is only one Actually, I mentioned two, you know, frameworks out of 71. Okay, so there are 71 learning styles or cognitive styles, you know, frameworks that we can choose from, and then we can say, okay, maybe this one is better. So the truth is, what the evidence suggests is that we learn in different ways, mm-hmm. and the more representations of something we have in our brains, the better. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a specific profile to learning, and it's always going to be like that. Yeah. So, and it's a very simple way to test that. So imagine I get a bunch of people, I apply the learning styles test, and I determine that they are visual. And then I just teach them using visual input. So they should perform better when compared to the same group taught using an auditory or kinesthetic type of input or class, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen. It really depends on what you're teaching. So if I'm teaching something that requires a lot of images, so I'm teaching something that has to be very visual, it doesn't matter if my student is visual and, you know, air quotes here, mm-hmm. so visual or not, because what really matters is the content and also the cognitive load, right? So if I can help my student make connections and learn from, let's say, different styles or in different styles, that's better.
Yeah.
And then, so that's why Howard Gardner himself, just to wrap up, he said, drop the styles. Is that, you know, don't use styles anymore. Right?
And a footnote here, because it's also something that I hadn't noticed before. And again, I was reading all his materials again. And there's something really important that he mentioned in the middle of his book, if I'm not wrong, it's chapter two. Two or three, one of these two chapters, if I'm not wrong. And he mentions, actually, he describes a student who, this student was taking the how do I pronounce this? I don't know how to pronounce this name. It's Horsack, Horsack. I really don't know how to pronounce that.
Yeah.
But he was taking the this profiles test, the learning styles test. And Gardner describes that this student was doing relatively well when his preferred styles were being explored.
Okay. But,
and he started denying some of the activities that were not of his preference. He did not, he was rejecting. He was like, it was a he, okay? That's why I'm saying he.
Okay.
He was, the student was like, no, I don't want to participate. I would want to participate. But at the end of the day, this student ended up participating and exploring the profile that was not of his preference.
Okay.
And he did just as well.
Exactly. That's he it. And I think you were referring to Horsch. I think it's a German name, right? Horsch.
Yes.
Ink blood test, right? That you can see all kinds of crazy.
Well, we're nerds. It's the same guy. It's the same guy. If you like Watchmen, it's the same
Watchmen,
guy that wears.
Course.
If the wears mask. The mask
with the blocks, that's
and it's that's a cool hard one name to pronounce. So I don't know how to pronounce that, but so this is really
important.
It's
Horsack. It's a German name.
Horsack.
Anyway, but that's a very interesting point, right? Because so why do we keep going back to Howard Gardner? Because I think he was pretty much responsible for popularizing the idea. He doesn't. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, he was the guy who proposed multiple intelligences, right? Mm-hmm. So he didn't really talk about learning styles like, you know, like visual auditory, but he looked at what other people had done before him. Mm-hmm. The guys that I mentioned here, Kolb and Fleming and Walter Burke. And then he created his theory. The book was Frames of Mind, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So the eight multiple intelligences.
Yes.
And that kind of reinforces the idea that there is a specific way in which you learn and that you should benefit from being taught in that way, right? So if a teacher teaches you in a specific way because you belong to a certain label or group, you're going to learn better.
Yeah.
But then going back, so we can move on to the kinesthetic profile.
Yes.
What neuroscience and neuroscience research shows is that we use multiple areas of our brains to learn. So it's very important. Many things are very important, but one thing that is really important is attention and then working memory. And then we have to consolidate that memory. And working memory is located in the frontal areas of our brain, right? Yeah. So you have, if you are put inside an fMRI machine, right, you're going to see that certain areas in the frontal lobe, they light up when you're learning new stuff. But then depending on what kind of thing you're learning, like, is it phonological information? Mm-hmm. Is it sound? Is it image? Is it both? Does it require movement or whatever? Then you're going to activate many different areas of your brain, because certain areas, they have certain functions in the brain. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not an absolute divide. It's not that like only this area is responsible for this. Our brain is highly interconnected, right? So we depend on many areas of the brain to do the simplest thing, like the basic stuff that we do. We need to use a lot of our brain. Yes. What does that mean? It means that if I put anyone inside an fMRI machine and I teach them anything, you're going to see a whole lot of lights, you know? You're
like a Christmas tree.
Fireworks. It's
a Christmas tree.
Exactly. So you're going to see a lot of activation in different places. You're going to see a lot of activation at the beginning in the frontal lobe because they're still learning. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to see more automatization in the parietal lobe. So, and language is very much connected with the motor cortex.
Yes.
So you're going to see a lot of activation here in this area of the brain. So that's where your motor cortex is.
Yes.
So, like between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. So it's very, I would say it's not nice to say that learning occurs in a very specific part of the brain, that you have one single predominant style, because it doesn't work like that. It's much more complex than that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And what you said is, I mean, there was, you're a neuroscientist, I'm a linguist, but we both deal with cognition. And there is a specific word you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that really catches my attention. That's, for me, it's important, super important here. Attention. Because once again, guys, when we're learning a language, and here, I'm not getting into the distinction between learning, acquiring, developing. I'm going to use the term learning for everything, just to have this conversation easily carried here. So when we're learning a language, first language, second language, third language, whatever language we're learning, we need to have the attention. Why? Let's use first language as an example here, because when we're babies, and once again, I'm going to say this, you know, because people are going to be like, but you're saying this again. Yes, because there is a big connection with what we're going to say, which is about movement and all these things. But when the baby is in a specific place, when the baby is in a place, and there's a lot of thing going on around this baby, there's probably some sort of interaction in front of this baby. This baby is paying attention to what, for instance, adults, parents, relatives, whatever.
Yeah.
What adults and people were doing in front of this baby, in front of him or in front of her. And based on this attention, the baby is going to be like, okay, so when this gigantic person with a big head is performing some sort of gesture, and this person says this, and the outcome is that. So basically, in a very simplistic way, this is a strategy that the baby is going to start creating when exposed to the language, when in an environment, in a given environment.
That's perfect.
And the movement is extremely important, as I said. We're getting into kinesthetic now, because move the language, because again, the baby is going to see a person with a box in the hand. Okay, the box is in hand, and the person is putting the box I don't know, in an upper shelf, and the person says, for some reason, okay, so I'm going to put this box in the upper shelf right now. And the baby is going to see the movement, this movement from getting a box from point A and putting it into a point B. The baby is going to see that, and the baby is going to realize, okay, so in whatever this person, this gigantic person said in this combination of words, there's something related to this movement.
Exactly.
That's the first step. That's the, you know, the
and they associate.
This is the seed of language learning. You know, because this is going to this is going to trigger learning of different of words, like so box. Yep. So I think this is the box. You know, box. Oh, upper shelf. Okay, so upper shelf, and then for some reason, the person is going to say, "Oh, let's put it in the lower shelf for some other day," and then the baby is going to be like, "Oh, so upper shelf is in a high place,
and even shelf is in the verb, right?
Verbs,
to put, like
to put.
Verbs are very much connected with movement, right?
Content words in general. So that's why movement plays a very important role in this whole language learning things. And that's why kinesthetic really, really benefit from this preferred style. And not, I'm not going to use learning style, this preferred style, because they like movement.
Yeah.
Like, basically, they love
preferred or like learning preferences. Let's just say teaching styles, that's better. So we can teach we can teach them, and there isn't one that is better than the other. That's the idea. We should use all of them. But when you mentioned something about movement and language, if you look at so we know Broca's area, for example, that is very close to the, you know, the motor cortex and the junction between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe and the temporal lobe and everything. And if you think about where the hippocampus is, so the hippocampus is the little seahorse that we have in both hemispheres.
Yeah.
And it's very much connected with making spatial memory and actually consolidating memory. So transferring from our working memory onto the cortex. So it's stored there. And we know there is a theory of how the hippocampus works, and it's called the cognitive map. So the hippocampus, we don't know for sure, but we might have something called the place cells. We have cells inside the hippocampus, just like mice. We don't know if we can actually find them in humans. But when you go to a place, it's like your brain is scanning the place and those cells are kind of lighting up. Hmm. And where is the hippocampus? In the medial temporal lobe. So there is a very strong connection with language there. So the hippocampus is going to add semantic value to whatever happens, you know? So when you're looking around and something happens and you see an object and you see a movement or whatever, you're going to assign a word or a term or an expression to that so that you can compute that and then learn from it. And actually hundreds of thousands of years ago, even a million years ago, the hominids, the first humans, they probably started speaking with sign language.
Yeah.
So because they didn't have the vocal apparatus with the vocal cords and everything. So they probably started using their hands and body language, nonverbal language. So language and movement are super interconnected, right?
Yes.
Because of that. And then, of course, we have to integrate movement in the way we teach somehow. I mean, not just for kids, especially for kids, but we're going to talk at the end also adults, right?
Yeah.
So that's the point. Yeah.
Yes. And because this movement that you've just said, this movement that we're being exposed to, and we don't lose that, we're never going to lose that. We start analyzing movements since we're babies. And we're going to keep doing that until we die. This is something that is inherent, is human, it's human, it's biological, it's universal.
Exactly.
So this, when we were paying attention to a specific kind of movement, so basically we understand the, so you're talking about intention, shared intention, joint attention, and all these things. So how does this work? So the baby is going to look at whatever the adult is doing, and the baby is going to be like, oh, okay. So whenever the big person is is performing some sort of gesture, you know, like thumbs up, okay, for us in Brazil, thumbs up means okay. In other countries, you know, it's a different
it might mean gesture. Something else, man. It might take be it easy.
So thumbs up here in Brazil means okay, everything's cool,
it's nothing obscene, guys.
It's nothing obscene here. So a thumbs up. So when the baby is paying attention to that for the first time, when the baby is seeing this kind of gesture for the first time, the baby is going to be like, oh, yeah. What does that mean? I don't
exactly.
know. And then the baby is going to look at that again, is going to be exposed to that again and again and again and again until the baby is going to be like, oh, so whenever the person is with their thumbs, with his or her thumbs up, the person is fine. The person is okay. Oh, so this is a strategy. And going back to Gardner again, that's why I really think that Gardner, he was, of course, a pioneer. You know, we're just going further. He is misunderstood. Because in one of his books, again, there he mentions when he's talking about the kinesthetic people, he mentions an athlete. And he says, so whenever an athlete is learning how to play some sort of sports, the athlete needs to pay attention, and he uses baseball. The athlete needs to pay attention to the hand movement, how to hold the baseball in a specific way in order to get a curveball or something like that. So, and he also uses people who like theater. You know, people who like to participate in plays, actors, etc.
Yeah.
Why is movement so important for these guys? Because they are going to associate so well, for instance, great actors, actors who win an Oscar, etc. Because they understand from words, from language. I mean, when I say language, I'm talking about words now again. I know that language is much more than this, just to simplify things. But the actors are going to look at a written language, for example, or whatever he or she is listening to. And this person is going to translate that into body language, like emotions.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. So the person is understands the intricacies of whatever is being told him or her. And this person can transform it into some sort of gesture. So language learning, because again, if you can translate something that's written into body language, you can perform that body language. You can translate that, whatever is written, whatever is being said to you, you translate that into some sort of movement. And this requires some strategies. And once again, then, this is a cue for you. This strategy is not only for the movement. We're going to transfer this ability to language learning.
Exactly. And you mentioned something about great actors. And it's so amazing. You know, I never cease to be amazed of, you know, how incredibly, you know, artistic and wonderfully magical some artists are in conveying things with, you know, facial expressions and gestures and, you know, just a look. And we can look at the person and know what they're feeling because we have that. Our brain can recognize that. And then, again, the importance of language and movement. We, one of the reasons why we evolved like these weird creatures we are nowadays and most other creatures are kind of like
dangerous.
The same. They have a head and dangerous, right? So they have a head that is actually the first part of their bodies. And that's where we have our eyes and our ears because we have to be able to identify movement that we have over other animals is that we assign semantics. We assign meaning to that movement and we classify and we categorize and we can communicate very easily and effectively what somebody's going to do, what they intend to do, right? And then that's why we shouldn't separate. And that's a problem I'm facing now. And I think most teachers and teacher trainers are facing right now. A lot of parents, they don't realize how important movement is in their kids' class, you know? So now that we're doing this emergency remote teaching, they actually want their kids to be sitting the whole day just listening to their teachers, watching videos and not doing much. That's bad, guys. That's terrible. The World Health Organization says it increases screen time, which is awful for your kid. I understand that it's an emergency, but you know what? it's better to watch a 1 minute video with instructions for you to jump around and make a project or whatever, than to sit for 25 minutes just listening to your teacher and doing whatever. So, and because kids are in a process of developing their movements, you know, so if you think about, we always go back to Piaget, right? So I have some reservations. Neuroscience has some reservations, you know, when it comes to Piaget. But there is a time in our lives when we're growing up that we start developing movement, right?
Yeah.
The sensory motor stage. And it's very important for us to move them. Because so imagine we kept a kid strained, you know, somewhere in the room, and they couldn't move, they wouldn't learn language well. They wouldn't acquire, in that case, language well. So we need to, and we have a wild feral kid in the U.S. that she was trapped. She, you know, like 12 years of her life, she was trapped. She suffered all kinds of violence, and then she didn't develop language well for, of course, psychological, you know, problems because of the way she was treated, and definitely because she didn't move and didn't get to explore the world. And that's how we learn. So, you know, if there were a kinesthetic profile, you know, if there were people who could learn better from moving, I would say, first of all, everybody can learn better from moving, you know. We should definitely include movement more. By simply asking them to relate whatever they are doing to language. And that's very important. And I think we're kind of losing that. And then parents, a lot of school managers, and even teachers, they don't see the point of playing, of moving around, of standing up, walking around the room, sitting down, listening to a story. Listen and point. That's so important. It tells us whether the kid was able to recognize something or not. Listen and point, you know?
Yes.
Listen and say and repeat, right?
Yes. A couple of years ago, I also wrote something that's also on Marcello Consultoria's page. We have a lot of articles there, just as you have at edcrocks.com. It's .com or .com.br?
I forgot. I think both. I have both domains probably.
You do? Okay.
But, yeah. Yeah,
just Google EDC Rocks and Google Marcello Consultoria. You're going
to find it.
Both websites there, and we all have articles there. But I wrote an great activity, not only for kids.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to talk about adults and kids in a couple of minutes. This is kind of like the cue again. I'm giving you, you know, I'm throwing you, I'm pitching you all the balls, man. All the balls.
But curveballs, man,
Knock him out of the stadium, dude. So when I wrote about Simon Says some years ago, the whole thing about that is that the first type of communication that we have when we're babies is pointing, because of course we don't actually know how to speak. We don't know how to translate whatever we're feeling into words. So that's the first type of connection that we have between movement and language that we're actually producing, okay? That we are actually producing. Because we do have some, we do have this connection before. The only thing is that we're not producing anything yet. But this is the first connection that we are having between language, movement, that we are producing. So this is really important. It shows that based on my movement, I can manipulate the attention of the person that I'm trying, that the baby is trying to communicate. Yep. And then the person is going to understand based on my movement only.
Exactly.
The person is going to play, the person is going to behave off of the movement that the baby is going to perform. And Simon Says is kind of like a good representation for that, because when you say Simon Says sit down, it's the other way around, because movement. Yep. So
it's exactly
like the opposite, but also it, but I never said that this is just a one-way street, you know. This I never said that, but it's the other way around, because they have to translate whatever they understood from the teachers or from the person that's responsible for, you know, singing, chanting, yeah. Simon Says, and translated into movement. And
exactly.
Once again, I'm going to refer to Michael Tomasello, because you mentioned what he said. Part of what he said, no, what he wrote based on his experiments, because this kind of movement is what is going to make us understand each other. This Perfect. Movement is going to make us understand each other. And the kinesthetic, or when we're exploring this side, yeah. or a side, because once again, we all have the style, we all benefit from yeah. movement here. So when we're exploring this side, and again, this is a teaching style that you sit down, think about your lesson plan, and you're going to say, okay, so I'm going to explore their movement now. This can also be yep. done online, you know, guys. This is possible
Definitely.
To be done
Definitely.
Online. Yeah. So now, yeah. guys, what you're going to do is find a way to sit down and make your students understand your body movement, because then... Yep. They are going to basically develop the strategy like, oh, so whenever the teacher is doing this, I have to do something. Yep. I have to behave in a certain way. And it's yep. possible to be done online. All you got to do is some sort of space. And if your students also have some space, they
can
do that.
It has to be done online, man, because this is what we have now.
Yeah.
And don't take movement from the lesson. You have yes. to keep movement in the lesson.
Maybe yeah. with kids, because if you're talking about age here, we know that yeah. When they're at early ages, they're learning whatever is going on with the world. They're learning social conventions. Yeah. So yep. they need this kind of movement. They need that. Otherwise, they're going to turn into robots. They know how to speak, but they have no idea yeah. how to communicate, because speaking and communicating, there's a big difference between these two yeah. words. They'll be able to speak, but they won't be able to communicate. Adults, yeah. and, just yeah. as important, just as important.
Definitely.
They don't actually need to let off yep. their energy. It's not the case that they have a lot of energy and they need to use yeah. the energy. Some of them are going to be like, oh my God, I'm super exhausted.
Yeah.
But it's also really important, because they are going to maybe use whatever strategy they already used some years ago for yep. certain types of movement. They are going to make this transfer, and they are going to apply into language learning.
Yeah,
this Definitely. Is so important.
And you know what, man? That's how the communicative approach is actually possible. If you think about it, if we've both worked at language institutes, and that we can only speak L2, and then L1 is forbidden and whatever. And we can teach. I mean, people learn. I mean, we don't actually have to resort to L1 in many cases. And how is that? So if we could look inside people's brains when they're learning, you would see a wonderful display of colors, and, like the lights. You would see that the teacher's body language, the movement, the teacher walking around the room, and facial expressions, and the way they move their hands, everything. Is being encoded by the brain, and the students are using the hippocampus, and they are not just getting the physical element of moving, but also the image. So if the teacher is looking at or pointing to something on the whiteboard or whatever, and the way they're speaking, what they're saying, so what our brain does is get all that input, all that information from the environment, and use the working memory and encode that visually, phonologically, and even movement is it's part of the spatial, the cognitive map of the hippocampus, and put that in an order, let's say, in a chronological order inside the brain. That's the working memory model proposed by Alan Badley, for example. So, us to only use the target language is through movement, through recognizing intention and what the teacher wants to say. And then, so there are certain conventions that we might, even if we were from a different culture, man, let's say we are Chinese and our Brazilian teacher, moves from Brazil, and the teacher is teaching us English in China, and then pointing, when you point at something, people look, Because that's kind of universal, right?
Yes.
So that's the first language that we have. It's moving. And you know, that's why when we talk about kinesthetic, we're not saying that people are, everybody is, not just, we're just saying that movement should be an integral part of teaching. And then the thing we do wrong most of the time is that we keep our students sitting most of the lessons, especially adults, because it's boring, you know. It's like they don't want to expose themselves by standing up and walking around and pairing up. So you play a song or something like
but
that.
But you know what? But you know what? You know, it's so interesting because we, of course, adults, they, you know, they have second thoughts before diving into some movement activity in the classroom or virtually. Yeah. But once they give it a chance, they love it.
They like it.
They have a great time because they
they do.
It reminds them of when they were kids. You know, it's there's some sort of nostalgia involved. So they are going to be like, "Oh, I'm a student again. I'm a kid again." So they're going to have a great time. And I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that there's a difference between speaking something and communicating. Because my essay for my master's degree was basically it. Because all my master's, my essay was based on Pamicello's studies, etc., on cognitive linguistics. And the whole idea, of course, I didn't have a chance to actually go on the field because I was a foreigner, but anyway, and I needed to get into a hospital for the whole thing. I was, you know, they wouldn't give me a clearance, you know, but the whole point, the whole study was when we're learning a language, we basically I separated people into three groups. One group that was going to learn a language purely through interactions. Another group that was going to learn a language 100% on their own. So basically relying on cognition. No interaction whatsoever. And the third group that would be, you know, a normal kind of language learning, interacting, and also if we're interacting, we're going to use our cognition as well. You know, it's
definitely
impossible to interact without using a cognition. And
cognition is everywhere.
Yes. So, why was that? Because in my study, I said, because when we have the group that doesn't have any kind of interaction, they're going to learn a language up to a certain point, but there's a lot that they're going to miss. And one thing that they're really going to miss is the intention. They're not going to know the intention because they won't know the social conventions. So as you said, for example, another thing that's also universal, if you go to any country and you look, if you stare at the person and you just move your eyes, like, you know, like,
everybody's going to follow, right?
Everybody's going to be like, okay, so I have to look somewhere, you know? Why? Because this is a social convention.
That's how we communicate, right?
Yeah. That's how we communicate. And then we're going to turn these this gesture into words. Because then this gesture, like, is going to be translated into something like, look.
Yeah, exactly.
God. Yeah. So you see, so that's the kind of association that we have when we have interaction in language, when we have movement in language. And once again, as you were just saying, we need to make our students move whatever age they have, whatever, however old they are, we need to make our students move. And me, again, as a super Italian, I don't know if you already noticed, but I use my hands all the time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I do this, I do that.
Me too, man. Me too. I'm not Italian, but I do the same thing because we're really excited. We're trying to convey meaning and, you know, expressing what we're trying to explain. And when you said that, it came back to me that I watched Dan Everett's TED Talk, and he's the guy who challenged Chomsky, and he said, there's not just a universal grammar, there are different grammars and whatever. And they're always fighting. And then he talked about language evolution, and he said something very interesting. It was when we were able to stand up on both our feet, that and when we created tools, probably that we had to use both our hands, that we started really developing, you know, verbal language more, because now we can't use our hands to sign, to show whatever we want. So we have to start. So we started probably screaming and grunting and doing, you know, making some very weird noises. And there's actually a theory that supports that. That, you know, it was when we were with our hands busy that we had to, but that doesn't mean that we changed the place in the brain. And that's what people get wrong. So the place in the brain where the motor cortex is still pretty much involved with language production, and not just production, but also comprehension. So we know that, so you know that, well, you study aphasia. So, you know, people with Broca's aphasia, they also have problems with comprehension, right? So it's not about the mechanics just of, you know, producing the language and the mechanics, but also it's almost like they, whenever they're listening to someone, they can't move that kind of muscle. It's not a muscle, guys, just, you know, an analogy here. The kind
guys
of muscle.
Guys on Spotify, Andre now is having some air quotes here. It's not a muscle.
It's not a muscle, but it's a way to kind of like, you know, I'm listening to someone, they're producing something, a sound, and I'm actually moving as if I were moving the muscle to understand that. And that's in the Broca's area, in our, it's actually here, very close to, you know, the junction between the frontal lobe, the temporal lobe, the parietal lobe, where the,
it's like the cornerstone.
Motor cortex, the cornerstone, exactly. So, and then we have to talk about kids and adults, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We have like five, eight, 7 minutes. I'm going to be super fast, I promise you.
Yeah.
Because you have to say a lot of important things.
We do.
Adults, I'm going to start with adults here because we're just saying constantly it's super important for them to move. Why? They already have some strategies consolidated.
Definitely.
Whatever strategy I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about language strategy, learning strategy. I'm not saying, I'm talking about strategies in general. So they already have, they already know where to go whenever they need to perform something.
Yeah.
And if we're talking about kinesthetic people who love movement, people who benefit from movement, et cetera, et cetera. Remember what Gardner said about the athlete? I can say that I lived that because when I played basketball, I remember that I constantly had to pay attention to the foot movements of other players. You know, like, I have to put my feet in this way, not in that way, because in that way I'm going to be unbalanced. So all these things are going to generate some sort of strategy, or actually generated some sort of strategy in my mind. Okay. So adults, they have these strategies. They already know how to do these things. So if they have movements, great. There's a chance that they're going to develop more strategies, or they are going to use the abilities that they've already developed, and they are going to put that into language learning, meaning that learning. I'm not talking about language, and I'm not talking about
learning in general, right?
Meaning creation. Yeah. No, I'm talking about learning the language. Like, because they are going to be like, when I learned how to play the flute or play the harmonica, that's the strategy that I used. Okay, so phonologically speaking, so what I have to do now is to move my facial muscles whenever I learned how to play the flute or the harmonica in order to produce some sort of sound, like the th sound or the p sound or the k sound or the n sound. So that's the same ability, which is a little bit different from kids, for example, because kids, they don't have this ability consolidated yet. They take a little bit longer in order to achieve a certain goal, but they will.
And you know, I'll just mention an example that kind of summarizes what you said. There was I don't know if this guy's still alive. You can do some research if you're interested. Clive Wearing, he was a British maestro. So he was a great pianist, and, you know, he conducted a huge orchestra, and he had a very weird disease in his brain. I don't know if it was bacterial or viral, but it kind of ate chunks of his cortex, you know? And we store things in the cortex. So, you know, memories and words and meanings, they are all over our cortex. So that means that he actually lost a lot of his memories. He could only remember his wife. Sometimes he would even forget his wife. He couldn't remember he had kids. He didn't know where he was going. He would always forget what he was doing, right? But if you put that guy in front of a piano, he could still play a whole symphony, like perfectly. And then people ask, but how is that possible? Because memories that are related to movement are normally stored in the cerebellum. So that's mm-hmm. in the back of our head, below our occipital lobe, right? But because they are part of a huge network, whenever this guy was playing the piano, you could talk to him and he would be almost normal. Like he would, you know, go back to his memories, right? The same thing kind of happens with Alzheimer's patients. So if you, you know, there's a moment that they don't know who they are, they don't know where they're going, they are very apathetic, you know, like you look at their faces, they're kind of like, they don't know that they exist. Mm-hmm. But then if you put some music on, music will trigger because there is dancing involved. Maybe he danced to that song. So they will trigger this huge neuronal network that will actually bring back some of their memories. And you can talk to the person as if they were normal for a very brief moment, right? But they kind of get their life back, you know? So it's amazing.
It's also one of the treatments for aphasia.
It's exactly. Also
dancing is one of the music, of course. And if there's music, there's dancing. But music and dancing, it's one of the treatments for aphasia, exactly because of this. Because they are going to use the part of the brains that were preserved, and there is a chance that they're going to have some sort of, you know, flashback, linguistic flashback, etc. So it's one of the treatments as well.
Awesome.
It's super
okay.
Cool.
Now we have to get into, so should we wrap up and talk about the news?
I guess so. How long do we still have?
We still have a couple of minutes, right?
Okay. All right. So
but go ahead. You wrap up.
I wrap up.
I'll just say one thing. I'll just say one thing. Don't get hooked up on this learning styles thing, because that if you use that, if you think like, okay, I only have kinesthetic students in my class, and then you're going to just prepare lessons for kinesthetic students, air quotes again, it's not going to work. Our brain needs input, you know, visually, phonologically, kinesthetically, and then we put everything together and we form a huge neuronal network. But movement is essential, and so is image, and so is sound. And we're going to talk about that in the next episodes. But just remember, there aren't really kinesthetic people, like in the sense that they learn better because they're kinesthetic. There are people who prefer to move, who prefer to include movement in the way, who feel comfortable. There are some people who don't. And maybe if we teach them to like movement, or even if they don't like movement, they can still learn better if they move. That's what I'm saying. That's what the evidence suggests, right?
Yes.
And that's
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And my final remarks here, exactly what you said. And don't you know, get too attached to learning styles. I mean, actually, do get attached. Study the learning styles, get to know the details, because if you get the details, if you go further into the readings related to learning styles, you're going to see that exactly what you have just said, Andre. We don't have only one style within ourselves. We are we're a mix of styles, and all of them
definitely
need to be explored. They have to be explored by us teachers. So we have to explore each and every one of our styles that we have. And also because we need to know which one our students like the most. Like, oh, okay, so they like that? Okay, what's the result that I'm having?
Yeah.
Good result. So let's explore this one a little bit more. A little bit more,
perfect.
Because if you get carried away and you keep exploring the exact same kind of characteristic of our students, they're going to get bored.
Yeah.
So, you know,
balance. True.
Balance is really important.
Trial and error. That's
exactly,
it.
Exactly. So the good news, right?
Yeah. Good news. Oh, yeah. So you tell them now.
All right, guys. So
that's awesome news, actually.
For you guys who are watching us both here on Instagram and on YouTube, guys, if you're listening to us on Spotify later, probably you've heard of breast tissue. And probably you're members of breast
tissue. And by the way, a quick remark, if you cannot see us because you're going to listen to us on Spotify, you should see our proud faces right now. I just wanted to say that.
If you're listening to us on Spotify, finish, because we're about to finish. Then as soon as you have some time, go to YouTube, watch the recording, and then go to EDC Rocks IGTV, because this episode is also going to be there. So you have plenty of opportunities to watch our proud faces now. So breast is... every 2 years, they host an international conference. A couple of years ago, the international conference was in Caxias do Sul. It was an amazing conference. We send proposals for talks, workshops, etc. And it was supposed to be this year, but because of this pandemic, it's the International Breast Tissues International Conference is going to happen next year in 2021.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a live version of Chá Pedagógico. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So if you guys really
like... It's awesome, man.
It's
proud.
It's super cool. So if you guys really like watching us on Instagram, on YouTube, if you like listening to us on Spotify, now we're going to have a real opportunity to actually have a conversation drinking tea.
We're going to be drinking tea there.
We're going to be drinking tea in front of you guys. So please
face
remember.
Face-to-face.
Yes, face-to-face. And please, guys, if you're not a member of Breast Tissue yet, become a member. It's a great association. Yeah.
It's really worth it.
It's the biggest association for English teachers in Brazil, the fourth in the world, if I'm not wrong. I think it's the fourth or fifth in the world, something like that. And next year, we're going to have this huge international conference. A lot
of
important people are going to come. And we're going to have an episode of Chá Pedagógico live, face-to-face, talking to you
we're
guys.
We're super
really
proud.
To you guys. So,
and thank you very much for following us, guys, because you know what? That's why we kept going, and we're going to keep going. Because you're there, you're sending, comments, interacting, watching us, and we're super happy.
Yes.
It's an accomplishment.
A great accomplishment by both of us. So, guys, once again, next year, 2021, Breast Tissue International Conference, it's going to happen in São Paulo, so it's going to be super easy for you guys to, commute.
1 minute left.
And
sorry.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
André, thank you so much, brother.
Thank you, man. And we're going to post.